This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's Thursday, the 2nd of March, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm Melissa Idris, and with me, Kusu Chuang, who's trying to make me smile and break character, as well as Tung Chung Han this morning.
I've only got one thing to say to you, Melissa. One more day. One more day.
Till Friday, till the weekend.
TGI Friday.
TGI Friday. There you go. Kusu Chuang right there. Well, coming up on the show today, we've got 4 hours of great shows for you, including on the Breakfast Grill, the CEO of Invest KL, Dato' Zainal Aman Shah. He's going to be coming on to address some recent news. Yesterday, it was announced that Invest KL is targeting 10 MNCs to come and invest within the Greater Klang Valley in 2017. If you compare that, it's slightly lower than what they managed to secure in 2016. They managed to get in 13 MNCs. What do you think about this slightly lower target?
The fact that he managed to attract 13 MNCs, and just a bit of background on InvestKL, okay? Mm-hmm. So they're this government agency tasked by the government to attract investment to the Greater KL region. So specifically KL and the Greater KL region, okay? Not Johor, not Pengerang, not Penang.
They
not,
all have their own correct. Different
correct.
Investment agencies.
Mm-hmm. Exactamundo. So what he does is he's supposed to just bring business to this neck of the woods. And the fact that he managed to do 13 in 2016 is interesting because a lot of the companies that come to Malaysia are oil and gas plays. They come here for the proximity to Petronas, who is basically Daddy Warbucks in terms of our capex spend. And they want to be close to Daddy Warbucks. Who doesn't want to be close to Daddy Warbucks, right? So 13 MNCs in 2016, interesting, not a bad job, made a fist of it. And so what they do is they're peddling KL in like a beauty contest, right? They're fighting with the Philippines, they're fighting with Singapore, Bangkok, etc. And it's a beauty parade.
Were most of the MNCs oil and gas, like you said, or did you see?
No, not really. Okay. Because what happens is Malaysia has positioned itself interesting in an interesting way because it, you know, the proposition here is principal hub. So there's all kinds of tax breaks and ease of doing business with raw materials and your supply chain for being a regional operation center. So companies are set up in KL, and you would run your accounting functions, your HR and procurement from KL. So, but you would have a global business.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and looking at this article in The Edge, you know, their focus areas include, IT, engineering and construction, in addition to oil and gas, right? Now, I also find it interesting that since Invest KL has been around since 2011, I believe, right? You know, they have created over 9,000 jobs. And for Malaysians, the average annual income is 114,000 ringgit.
So, for those guys, lah.
Yeah, and I was like, man, that's a pretty cushy job.
Okay, I have to ask you, John, because you know you've been following InvestKL and the progress for since they first started, right? What do you think about Malaysia's attractiveness as part of this beauty parade within the region?
It's not bad because the main things are the location, the English speaking workforce.
What about our cost? Are we relatively low cost?
Yeah, and the cost of basically the cost of doing business, the cost of rentals, cost of labor. You know, low salaries.
Where are the pimples on this beautiful face?
Well, there are quite a few. Obviously, in terms of infrastructure, you know, it doesn't match Singapore, but then it comes at a price, Singapore, right? Because obviously you've got the exchange rate. And the exchange rate is a big catalyst as well because a cheaper ringgit, a lower ringgit bodes well for their cost of doing business. I mean, if you're an American company coming here, and you've got Oracle here, Novartis, of course, is here.
Big companies.
The sterling, the dollar. They come in here as cheap as chips. Do you know what I mean?
Cheap as chips. You are just full of words today.
I am.
Full of words. But then, you know, when you're looking at these numbers, and I mean, they seem to paint a rather, you know, positive outlook, right? You know, with this kind of track record. So what do you think is missing in the message? You know, because you know, despite InvestKL having been aggressively going about attracting MNCs since 2011, but yet you know, when you look at, say, the business sentiment and consumer sentiment, they seem to be on a downward trend. So what do you think is missing here?
Well, I mean, you got to do business. ASEAN is only one of the few growing regions in the world. You've got, you know, I mean, South America is you know, wading through some problems. The Americans, the Europeans. So ASEAN is one of the fastest growing blocks. The thing is, when you compare the numbers that Malaysia gets compared to, say, Singapore attracts something like $30 billion in investment a year.
Wow.
A year, okay? And Singapore's a pimple compared to Malaysia.
What's with all the pimple reference, guys? Come on.
It's a blemish.
It's a little dot.
It's a dot.
And this dot gets 30 billion.
Oh, my.
Do you know what? So companies would love to go there because they've got the rule of law, they've got a court, you know, they've got a... I mean, they've got a legal justice
and the
system.
Livability. They're quite high on the livability.
There's no crime. You know, everybody's an expat there, and you know.
Okay.
You
might well, that's very interesting. I'm curious to know more. Jim Rogers.
You might. You never know.
Just at your local Starbucks,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Eduardo Saverin down the road.
There you go. Rub shoulders with the big guys. There you go. CEO of Invest KL, Datuk Zainal Aman Shah, will be joining us on the Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock, and after the grill on Current Affairs at 8:30, we're going to take a look at the carbon trading deal that the Kelantan government struck with climate protectors, promising to preserve over 300,000 hectares of forest in exchange for income generated from sales of carbon credits. Now, while this may sound like a positive move, it has drawn some backlash from the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, as well as several environmental groups. So we asked Hilary Chu, which is one of the non-profit environmental groups called Third World Network, to find out why exactly this deal has drawn the backlash it has.
Carbon offset has been found to be not able to address the issue of climate change because you're basically not doing actual emission reduction and you are outsourcing your emission reduction. As we all know, climate change is a serious problem, and the science has shown us that we have already surpassed the safe level, and we have to, in the very near future, for the 5 to 10 years, we have to cut emission rapidly. So if we are not cutting emission, but instead we are doing all these kind of other things, there is actually a distraction from actual emission reduction, we are not going to be able to bring down the emission and to stabilize the climate.
That was Hilary Chu from Third World Network, which is a non-profit environmental champion group. Really quite interesting because I thought that this was a good deal, but clearly she, in her experience, thinks that it's not been effective simply because you're not doing anything to cut carbon emissions,
correct.
You're just taxing it.
Yeah, the carbon trading mechanism is actually something dreamed up by the financial guys. Basically, you supplement or you substitute what you should be doing by buying and trading carbon credits on the carbon trading market.
Right, but don't you think it's a disincentive to emit carbon emissions? You know, you tax them, you charge them.
But she's right, because you know, if you believe someone like Sir James Lovelock, you know, we've really gone past the point of no return, and even Paris, has agreed that the world is warming too quickly. We've had 3 or 4 years of the warmest years on record consecutively. So she's right.
But what about the argument that, you know, for us emerging economies, it's our turn to catch up, where else, you know, all the existing, you know, carbon emissions, you know, have predominantly come from the developed world already?
Well, sorry, it's a poor argument. And I think China's woken up to that realization because, sorry, if you haven't had your time in the sun, I'm afraid it's too late, because if you don't sort it out, you know, there will be no world to exist in.
Well, still, no, like 10 million ringgit apparently for the Kelantan government's coffers within 24 months from this deal. Yeah, so, you know, something to look at in terms of opportunity cost, right? 10 million ringgit versus the environmental cost.
Well, let's find out more on Current Affairs, the specifics about why we have the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, as well as environmental groups unhappy with this climate or carbon trading deal with the Kelantan government. Find out more at 8:30 and at 9:30 on Ringgit and Cents that we have every Thursday. The topic today is how to use your home equity to reduce debt. Was a topic, I believe, that was quite large, asked about during the last Ringgit and Cents, asking about, you know, mortgages and whether to pay off loans, to pay off your mortgage.
Yeah, I find that a bit, another example of shonky financial engineering, because if you say you built up a head of steam with your house, say you're ahead of your payments. Okay, say you bought a house for 300,000 ringgit, okay, and today it's worth 600,000 ringgit. You've got a headroom of the 300,000 to refinance at low interest rates to pay off your other debt, your credit card debt, your car debt. The thing is, it just extends your pain in terms of paying off your home mortgage that much longer.
Right.
But it does make sense if you're cutting your credit card debt, for example.
Yeah, which is high,
18%
high interest. Mm-hmm.
But then a lot of people do that because they don't have the discipline to use that money and then to sock it away for good use. They just take that excess cash and then go and buy some useless stuff like an iPad or some MP3 player or something. And you then, you know, the whole cycle just starts again.
Yeah, you're right. That was really quite interesting because the last ring-in we had on Ringgit and Cents last week, a lot of the questions were about, you know, given the tough investing climate, should I take the money that I wanted to invest in and pay off my debt first? And that was a really quite an interesting question. If you want to know more about that, you can download the podcast of the month of February's Ringgit Ring-In. You can find that on our website or our brand new BFM app. But very quickly, guys, let's take a look at some of the news that happened overnight. Yesterday, there's news that legendary actor Tan Sri Jin Samsudin had passed away at the age of 82. Now, his son, Putra Hang Jebat Jins,
Name. Are you serious?
Putra Hang Jebat is the name of Jin Samsudin's son. He spoke to Astro Wani and said that his father had just finished having tea at about 5:30, 6 o'clock when he started having breathing difficulties and he had choked on his food, so they brought him to the hospital or to the clinic, and that's where he passed. The Taiping-born actor turned director was particularly noted for his award-winning films Bukit Kepung, as well as Sergeant Hassan and Ali Setan.
Wow, so, okay. I don't know the man.
Yeah,
but,
you guys not familiar with this. I used to watch him growing up, so you know I'm
handsome
very familiar.
Pala.
Handsome, but also compelling to watch on TV. Just compelling.
A bit like Han, actually.
I mean,
too bad this is radio.
I remember thinking, you know, watching Sergeant Hassan, thinking, my goodness, what a handsome man.
Whoosh.
Yeah, in black and white, but still so handsome. Sepia tone makes everyone look very handsome.
Correct.
So he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2011, and last night was just an outpouring of grief and condolences on social media. But in other news, we have sugar prices, which have quietly gone up by 11 cents per kilogram. Although there has yet to be any official announcement made by the Ministry of Domestic Trade and Cooperatives and Consumerism. So right now, a kilogram of sugar costs 2.95 ringgit, which is a 4% increase since the last price adjustment in 2013. And really quite interesting because this was confirmed by the president of the Federation of Sundry Goods Merchants Association. And he said that the ministry didn't give any formal communication. There was no directive. There was no official letter. It was a text message or a WhatsApp message that was given yesterday to execute this. So for me, it's a really puzzling decision. I mean, the lack of transparency is really worrying. But according to the president of this association, Hong Chi Ming, he's saying that, the reason why the government had, he's speculating the reason why the government had avoided making an official announcement was to prevent hoarding and consumers from panic buying. Do you think he has a point there?
Well, you know, perhaps, you know, but at the same time, like when we look at, say, the RON 95 and price adjustments, when we moved to that floating, you know, all that managed floating system, right? Initially, the government had rolled out all these like announcements, I think, like, you know, like a day in advance. But then they stopped doing that as well, right? So I think
because why you'll see like long queues at the. I mean, we as consumers have we add to the problem, right? Because we panic buy, we hoard, we queue up and cause massive traffic jams.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. So you would think that'll be one of the ideas, you know. But at the same time, you know, yeah, I think you gotta spare a thought for the average Malaysian consumer here.
True.
Because we do love our sugar, you know. If you look at my belly, like, you'll know. So going up by 11 cents per kilogram, yeah, that's
the four.
It's a real increase because a few. In fact, actually, happened quite a long time ago. Because about a week and a half ago, you know. You know, the ball and chains, actually, the wife went to the supermarket. And,
your better half.
The better half. I was like, what? Ball and chains.
Okay, got it.
She came back and she was, you know, she was all
riled up.
Riled up, you know, because the price of sugar had just gone through the roof. It was actually much more than 4% because the brown sugar that we buy is actually a lot more expensive. Hmm. And the thing is, you know, sugar is one of the staple items under this whole GST thing.
It's controlled.
It's one of the controlled items. Mm. And for this to happen, for something so wide-ranging and for there to be no official announcement, and when you consider the fact that there's a sugar monopoly in this country by Tan Sri Saad Mokhtar Al-Bukhari, who bought that monopoly from Robert Koch, some say under duress, or sold under duress. So obviously, MSM wants a price increase because they've been suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I wonder how much all of this is political.
Right, but at the same time also, you know, like when you do see this kind of news flow at the street level or the Pasar Malam level, do they sell sugar in Pasar Malams? I don't know.
Well,
it's been a while since I've gone.
Everything has been is sugar, right? So even though the price of sugar has gone up, I mean, everything from your kueh to your food, right. Your drinks, everything will be impacted.
That's right. And so all too often, then we see, you know, like, traders then taking this, like this kind of news to basically use it as an excuse to then really hike up their rates disproportionately, right. You know, and at the end of the day, it's the Malaysian consumers who suffer, you know. So I would like to think that that may not happen now, but I doubt it.
Well, I wonder what Milo Ice will cost going forward. Also, very quickly, some other news. Tan Sri Vincent Tan says he has no plans to sell his interest in any of his football assets. I think there was some panic among the football fans here following a report by Bloomberg titled "Embattled Millionaire Plans to Sell Football Teams." So Vincent Tan has Cardiff City, Los Angeles, Bosnia Sarajevo group, as well as a Belgium football team.
Yeah, well, it's only Cardiff, right, Chuang? So not that big a deal.
I don't know why Bloomberg wrote the story, because, I mean, you know, it's not as if Vincent Tan is, you know, in need of a spare penny or two. So,
right, but I love the Bloomberg headline, though. It's like, mustachioed Malaysian millionaire.
That was a very catchy headline. So, and immediately, you had a picture of Tan Sri Vincent Tan. You know what I mean? Like, you just had
image. He's apparently selling it because he's unpopular with the fans. Mm-hmm. Now, of course you're unpopular, right? You change the
color.
Colors. Yeah. You put all these feng shui friendly items on the fixtures list. Right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you expect?
Yeah. And I think they changed the mascot as well from like a bird to a dragon, you know, because it's more sing
on the you know on the back of your you know feng shui characteristics.
Yeah.
Come on.
Also,
you know
news
mean?
That Penguin Random House will reportedly pay more than $65 million for the global rights to write two books written separately by the Obamas. So Barack is going to write one, Michelle's going to write one. But at $65 million, reportedly, this is going to set a new record for presidential memoirs.
This smells a lot like Tony and Cherie Blair, doesn't it? Because,
really?
I mean, when they left the political circuit, they hit the speaking circuit, and they were commanding fees of about $300,000-$400,000 per time. So,
right.
And then there were book deals, and then, you know, there were roles with J.P. Morgan. So you can fully expect, you know, Barack and Michelle would be treading very much the same path.
Well, no, Hillary Clinton also did the same thing, right?
True,
you know,
right.
So, what, 200...
And she was just Secretary of State.
Yeah, 200,000 per engagement, like, phew, you know,
that's,
come on.
Yeah, yeah. The truth, that's
forget
right.
about it.
That's huge, right? Okay, all right, 18 minutes past 6 o'clock, we'll be back with more news after this here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Getting Better by the Beatles there. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Tan Chung Han and Koo Soo Chuang, 6:22 on the clock right now. Taking a look at some of the recent news about graduate unemployment. Now, it's a really worrying level because the Malaysian Employers Federation said that last year alone there were 200,000 unemployed graduates in Malaysia, and that number does not include the ones that have just completed their SPM diploma and certificate program. This is just coming out of university with a first degree. 20,000 graduates don't have jobs, couldn't find jobs last year, and that really made the Ministry of Higher Education and Job Street question, why is it that these graduates cannot find employment opportunities? Is it the lack of opportunity in the job market, or is it something lacking of the graduates?
I think it's something much more fundamental because, okay, just to frame this reply, okay, I was watching Lee Kuan Yew last night on YouTube, and about a couple of years before he died, he gave a series of interviews to reporters from the Straits Times, about, you know, 35 hours worth, and was, you know, entitled Hard Truths to Get Singapore Going. And one of the questions that asked to Kuan Yew was, you know, will you continue your policy of attracting MNCs and foreign talent onto Singaporean shores on the premise that, you know, obviously Singaporean local workers would be crowded out and not be able to compete? And his reply was, once you subsidize and once you allow incentives for, you know, local graduates to not compete on merit and to not basically try and be the best that you can be, then you will have serious repercussions in the workforce. And I think he's right, because in Malaysia, we've got a whole bunch of incentives, and there's a culture of entitlement in Malaysia. And that's the problem. When you grow up, you think that the government will look after you. You think that you'll get a job in the civil service. You think that you'll be looked after and sorted out.
But you know, I mean, that's a very sweeping statement. There are many people who don't have that kind of mentality, but are just facing trouble finding opportunities or finding jobs, simply put. And I think it's beyond... beyond just a feeling of entitlement, especially if you look at the figures. A majority of unemployed fresh graduates are from public universities. That's half of the graduates from public universities. Half of the number of unemployed graduates are from public universities. And that's really quite disconcerting, because according to employers who took part in this Job Street survey, it said it didn't matter to them whether the graduates are from public, private or foreign universities, but at the end of the day, it looks like, you know, they're having difficulty finding jobs.
Yeah, no, when we...
Did you get that, hon? I mean, you're reasonably young, all things told, compared to me anyway.
Thanks a lot, buddy. I appreciate it. When we normally talk about this kind of issue, you know, the usual culprits being cited as the reason as to why these younguns
are not getting jobs. We're talking about those below the age of 24, because six out of 10 out of those unemployed are below the age of 24.
So the usual culprits are the lack of English proficiency, you know, not being able to communicate well. But then now, at least according to this article, it seems to be a poor attitude. And I tend to agree with my older, more esteemed, experienced colleague.
Wiser. Yeah, my learned wiser, colleague.
Yeah, over there to my right, yeah, Gu Su Chuang. You know, yeah, because to say it's a poor attitude, I think that's a sweeping statement as well, because, I mean, fundamentally, Malaysian society has also grown richer, right? So hence, we can afford those safety nets, be it at the government level or even at the family level, right? As household incomes rise, you can then subsidize your child not being in the workforce. And presumably, this is mainly for the middle class. So perhaps that poor attitude comes from the comforts that we as an economy, you know, has enjoyed overall. That's what I think, at least.
Well, this is quite interesting as well, because about 70% of the employers surveyed think that fresh graduates have an unrealistic expectation for salary and unemployment benefits. And I'd like to just flip this statement on its head and say, well, maybe because the wages are so depressed. I mean, I have to say that perhaps, you know, the starting salary of a graduate has not changed since I started in the workforce many years ago. And it hasn't changed that much. And I have to say, it's many years. I mean, it should have gone up, but it really hasn't.
Yeah, that's of course true, and it's a truism of the economy. But you do what it takes, because if your parents have sent you to university and they've basically remortgaged the house to send you and pay for your fees, you come out and you do what it takes to get a salary. If you turn down the 3,500 ringgit job because you think it's too low, then obviously something's wrong with you, because you got to do what it takes. You've got to take that job and then take a second job or drive an Uber, because you have got to make ends meet. You can't change the system. You can change yourself.
No, I agree to a certain extent. But at the same time, say, you know, given previous generations, the path forward or the path, you know, moving up the ladder was a lot more clear cut. You graduate from university, you get that first job, and then, you know, as you move on up, you know, you are able to more easily sustain a family, a household based on a single income, yep, right, household. But nowadays, when the fresh grads come out, they're saying, nah, my parents are having to work two jobs. And like you said, Chuang, they had to basically sell off a home to pay for my education in the UK or States or whatever. Like, I can't settle for $2,000. Like, the path forward is just not as clear cut anymore. And it's so much more competitive.
I just want to, you know, what are the repercussions of this to wider society, right? And I wonder whether it's because... now we have so many different types of degrees. It used to be, you know, you go become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, an accountant, a dentist, and you'll be able to get a job, right? But now we have, you know, degrees in fashion design and video gaming and all sorts of other things.
And it's become, you can get an income from that.
But sometimes it's harder to get a job. You know, it's not as marketable of a degree. And that I think perhaps parents might be using that as an excuse to say, well, you should get a more marketable degree as opposed to getting a degree in philosophy, for instance.
And I totally agree, you know, and I guess this is where my experience comes in as well, because I think due to the rise, the more comfortable levels or standards of living here in Malaysia, you know, no longer do you just rely on, be a doctor, be a dentist, right? So when it came my time to choose a college career, my parents and many of my peers, you know, we were all told, go do what you want. Go be happy.
Exactly. That's a generation. That's a generation.
Find yourself. Well, then guess what? When you graduate with a psychology degree, what are you going to do with it? Exactly. So we were basically told, you know, these impressionable minds were told to go and discover yourself in college.
So do you think this is the repercussion of that?
Yeah.
Of having, you know, a degree in filmmaking and not then being able to find a job in the job market?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, because, hey, look, I actually worked for Warner Brothers, HBO, and all those studios in the States. When I got there, it wasn't about what degree you had. It was who you knew. My colleagues were, I was a son of the producer. That's why I got the gig here. And like, what the heck, right? So, again, I think it's these kind of problems come from the comforts of becoming a richer, I guess, you know, almost first world problem.
So, Han, would you tell your son to get a degree in, you know, law or accountancy just to ensure that he would have a job, you know, in the future?
I would actually tell him to go make robots, AI, you know, something along those lines, because those robots are the ones taking that. We spoke about this yesterday,
exactly.
How JP Morgan came up with this software that took out all these lawyers. Yeah.
The problem with all this is that everybody's contributory to the problem. The government with this English, you know, language attitude. Program, the parents with their, you know, go forth and be what you can be,
right.
You know, the kind of thing. And but it all starts and ends with a child itself, or the graduate child.
Itself,
if you don't want to go and get your hands dirty, like, you know, you go to Australia and kids there, they'll do the paper round, they'll go and, you know, mow the lawn, they'll do what it takes, you know, to get some income. Kids here won't do that, especially in KL. You think, ask them to go and do a paper round, they'll be like, no way, man, it's too hot or whatever. Or, you know,
okay, we've got Keith Kam now, standing by with the first news bulletin of the day at 6:30, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Somebody's Baby by Jackson Brown there. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run, 6:40 on the clock. And here's Ku Su Chuang, who is Somebody's Baby, and Tan Chung Han, who's perhaps also Somebody's Baby.
My brother from another mother.
Perhaps.
Right, okay, so we're looking at a medical, medical research results here that show that that desk jobs, a new study has shown that spending too much time sitting down or at your desk job is really bad for your heart. So the research found a link between sedentary work and a bigger waist circumference and a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Is this confirming what we already suspected?
I guess perhaps. I mean, looking at my waistline, I think I am victim of this trend here. All right, so according to this article, so the problem starts after the fifth hour of sitting down. So
that's about lunchtime, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Correct.
Maybe
correct.
It is just a lunch effect. So for every hour after that fifth hour, so by the sixth hour, you grow fatter by 2 centimeters and the risk of heart disease grows by 0.2%. You know, so it does confirm, you know, what we have also been told by various research and all these medical, you know, practitioners and whatnot. But then, I mean, what I find interesting from this article is that now, in order to counter those risks, you have to walk 7 miles. 7 miles. Now, that's about 11.6 kilometers. And thanks to Google Maps.
11.6 kilometers.
Yeah. Wow. So I did a quick search on Google Maps. That would be the equivalent of walking from the BFM studios to, you know where? Sunway Pyramid. Every
BFM
day.
BFM studio in Bandar Utama.
Where you can walk into a KFC.
This is...
Or McDonald's.
Right.
This is every day. You have to walk about 11 kilometers.
Yeah, we wasn't meant to be at tables. We wasn't meant to be in front of computer monitors. We were meant to be out scavenging and hunting animals for food.
I can't walk 11 kilometers a day, Chuang. I can barely walk to my car.
I know people who get in their car to drive 100 meters down to the road to the 7-Eleven.
Hey, hot la.
I know, but
very hot. I don't want to sweat.
It's all kind of a bit bizarre, but this is the reality of urban city life. Yeah. This is what it is.
And then, you know, it goes back to the whole attitude thing, right? Then you got this older generation who tell us, when I was your age, and I walked to school and walked back and had a paper route apparently.
Don't talk about Kusichong like that. Okay, all right. So this is just essentially saying that you have to exercise, get up more, do more, right? But I'm just wondering, I mean, realistically speaking, how many of us can do this, you know, can incorporate exercise into our desk jobs every day?
Actually, it's possible because you can actually walk up the stairs to your office.
Okay.
You can walk a lot of times to the toilet, like I know some people do that. You can walk and talk to the girls next door. And you can do all that. You don't have to sit
that
there.
That doesn't
inert.
Sound like a very productive person, to be completely honest with you.
That's what you got to do because you'll die. I'm serious. I mean, okay. It might sound facetious, but you have to get your body moving.
That's true.
That's what it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, fine. There are these measures or that you could take. Now, I think that's key with that you could. But then at the same time, you know, given the demand, the endless demand to be productive, you know, given all these kind of desk-bound jobs that we have out there, I mean, I'm sure, you know, InvestKL, when they bring all these jobs in, a lot of them presumably are desk-bound jobs as well, you know, despite their cushy paycheck, right? So, you know, when you have that workplace culture, the existing norms, you know, how do you go about breaking that, you know?
You know, employers also play a really important part in this. Just, I think, encouraging a healthy lifestyle in the office will go a long way for them, you know, increasing productivity, reducing sick days, things
the
like
gym memberships,
things like standing desks are actually really
very
important
good for you.
Because research has also shown that it's how many times you get up and stand up. So even though you have a desk-bound job, getting up constantly throughout the day and standing up for long periods of time is actually really good for you because it's the sitting down and the posture and the hunched over the keyboard. That's what's bad
it's
for
so
you.
It's so bad for your back. It, you know,
we talked about this,
midriff.
Didn't we, Han? Called the eye hunch. Now, there's a new posture that's related to the time spent sitting in front of a screen, be it your computer or, you know, your tablet.
Is that a new Apple
product? It's called the eye hunch. It's the wonderful bell hunch that you get from your back when you're hunched over a tiny screen. So there you go. It's called text neck.
Is that the Notre Dame effect, is it?
Notre Dame effect, that's right.
The hunchback.
The hunchback effect. Okay, so there you go. Try to walk at least 7 miles today, 11.6 kilometers.
Banda Utama to Sanmi Pyramid.
Where does the KFC?
All right. So the other thing that came across that caught our attention this morning as well was the fact that midlife crises are now a thing of the past. So what we normally think about crisis of identity, purpose, or belief at midlife—that's the midlife crisis. Apparently, the phenomenon of the midlife crisis has never been proven to exist statistically. In fact, it's driving factor. Fears over mortality, loss of role and relationships, and professional burnout. In fact, those are more appropriate to those who are older than midlife. So according to a geriatric psychiatry practitioner, the late life crisis is a trend that's up and coming.
Sorry, can I just debunk that notion of midlife crisis being not statistically proven? I am living, breathing proof of a midlife crisis. Except I haven't gotten the Porsche. I haven't gotten the mistress. I haven't done all that. I've just gone traveling and just been a bit more, become more of an irritant to my wife.
Poor wife. All right, so maybe there is such a thing as midlife crisis, but there's also an upcoming trend called the late life crisis. So in their 70s and 80s, you know, people are going through existential questions. They're asking about how they want to deal with mortality and, you know, relationships and love and family and all that.
Yeah, and it makes sense because as the life expectancy rates, you know, for humans now go, you know, we basically live longer, right?
Yeah.
You know, so with all that extra time here on Earth, you know, what you gonna do with it?
Yeah, Chuang. 45 is the new 45.
65 is the new 45.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, look, it can be precipitated by a number of factors. I mean, you know, part of the reason why I became what I am today is because one of my best mates, you know, died of cancer last year. Yeah. And it's kind of like related to all this work and life balance and how unhealthy we've become. And, you know, so after that, I just began to question a lot of things, and I went traveling and, you know, decided to have more work-life balance. And I mean, in some cases, like this, in this case from the journal, this 93-year-old man, his wife is at home with, I think, Alzheimer's or something. She was bedridden. He decided to go, you know, drive 30 miles across town in the middle of a traffic jam to see his lover, who was a lot younger than him at 80. And, you know, the doctor in this case was obviously, you know, came across the patient. He was smitten with love as he was a young teenager, but he was 93 years old.
Wow, so that's nice.
It's fantastic, right?
I can totally see you doing that, Chong, at 93.
I can do it. I can see me doing it now.
Hey.
No, but
we need to call your wife.
Okay. I have to say, though, it's an interesting, I think it's something that we have to deal with, because often the elderly are forgotten, right? You know, you think, oh, these
are... I think it's fantastic that you can find a, you know, love at 93.
Yeah, but it feels like so out of sorts for society, but we have to deal with the fact that we're living longer, and as we live longer, we go through again yet another crisis point in our lives, and you know, have existential questions. So, how would the children and the grandchildren be dealing with that?
They
phenomenon?
Should rejoice. I mean, you know, can I just say in the US, the average life expectancy of a male and female goes up by a year every year. Do you know what I mean?
Right now,
do you know that?
It crossed the 90 mark. Wow. Recent news was that it crossed the 90 mark for South Korean women.
Yes, and it's 84 in America, but it's gone up a year every year for the last
amazing,
3 or 4 years.
Amazing, right. Yeah.
Because of medicine.
No, but then at the same time, I wonder if this is a slippery slope of sorts. Now, hear me out, because, like, for example, no offense, Chong, but Mel and I, you know, we are out of the just do it generation, right? We grew up with this whole just do it Nike mentality.
I'm not just done it, lah.
You just done it and tired already. I need a nap.
Tired,
generation.
Tired.
Anyway. Anyway, so given that, okay, when you see the current or these 93-year-olds doing this right now, and they have grown up and have been socialized into with a more conservative worldview, right? Yet they're still pulling these kind of stunts off. What more for our generation, though? I wonder, because we grew up with a just do it now, and you know, who knows what kind of shenanigans that we'll be up to when we are at 93. You know, I wonder if this is a slippery slope.
But you know, it also, if you zoom out, right? If someone has a late life crisis at that point in time, you know, and it will change the dynamics of the relationship with the family, with, say, the way you would think about succession or what you want to leave your family or a legacy that you want to leave behind. It will change all that. I definitely think that this is something society should pay attention to.
And also our sense of, say, long-term commitment, though, because, you know, say, in marriages in previous generations, till death do us part was probably, like, you know, just a few decades. You know, now if, let's say, you're getting married at 30 and you're living till you're 90, that's 6 decades
of
till death do us part.
Can I just tell you guys about my new latest role model, okay?
Okay.
This guy, his name is... His name is Gianluca Vacci, okay? He's 49 years old, okay? He's an Italian clothing millionaire, okay? He lives the life of Hugh Hefner. He's an Instagram superstar.
What's his name again?
Gianluca Vacci.
Okay.
Okay, he dances. He loves to dance. He's got this really, you know, well, you know, very easy on the eye, his girlfriend. And he's fit, he's tan, he's wealthy.
La Dolce Vita for the Italians, right? Okay.
You know what I mean? It's 49 years old. It's something you normally associate with.
So what do you admire so much about him? His zest for life?
The joie de vivre.
Ooh.
The joie de vivre.
You went from Italian to French. What just happened
there? How quickly Edward de Bono'd it.
For us bona fide Malaysians, then what does that even mean?
Well, you know, you just embrace life. I mean, if I have a dad who's 95 years old, 93 years old, and, you know, say for example, you know, my mom, bless her soul, you know, not around, and he finds a second wind at 93, I'd say go for it, man. Mm. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's life.
Fantastic. Well, there you go. That's Kusa Chong's new role model in life.
I just thought of a business idea that maybe we should come up with an app for, you know, really
for
senior
old people.
Like a Tinder, but for seniors. Like,
matchmaking.
Yeah. And then you can have like ancillary products like, you know, Viagra.
I don't think you should limit it. You know, why limit it to a certain age category? I'm sure there will be older folks who want to meet younger folks as well. Younger folks who want to meet older folks.
Yeah.
Why not mash it all into one pack?
I think Tinder's shares just went down. I don't want to be swiping around on a 90-year-old.
That's you talking. 6:52 right now. We've got the news coming up right at the top of the hour. That's just coming out in about 8 minutes or so. After that, Market Watch with Ben Lebrun from Sydney, Australia. But right now, we've got Strata by Kiss on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.